Hello and welcome to. I'm still in.
We
have
cut
a thing,
heads.
Spike Lee. No, Shoot the Piano Player, a French New Wave podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me is I respect Tati too much to compare him to Joel. It's Joel.
I'm a little boy who's wearing his little bathing shorts backwards. Isn't that adorable?
All right, this is the first special episode. Yeah, so this is on Jacques Tati, who I should start off now by saying he might be my favorite French director. And he's also Russian, so I saw that as an excuse to bring on a returning guest and friend of the show, Alistair.
Hello, thank you for having me on again.
Oh, you're welcome.
May I ask Alistair a quick question?
Of course.
Has anyone ever mistaken your podcast, Russophiles Unite, for a Rene Russo fan podcast?
Alas, no. there's probably like an interesting Venn diagram of those two interests, though.
Yeah. People who love the remake of the Thomas Crown Affair and also Russian movies.
Indeed, it's a large demographic that is so far untapped.
Writing down this idea.
Yep.
All right. First off, this is Jacques Tati. We're only covering one of his movies, even though realistically, probably could cover a couple more because there's so few, and they're it wouldn't be like a slog or anything to get through them, but we chose what I think is probably the most fun one.
You've seen all of them though, right?
All his features I have. Haven't seen his TV movie from 70s that he did. And there's a kind of a new one from like 10 years ago where they took a script from that they wrote I think towards the end of his career.
You mean Illusionist?
Yes. And that is like basically trying to approximate what he would have done, both animation.
Oh, and, very cool.
And I watched a trailer and it did make me cry. So I probably will see it at some point. But so Jacques Tati. I can't remember how I first heard of him. It just kind of was a thing. Like once I heard about like Criterion and like Criterion type directors, I was like, oh, Jacques Tati, that's a name I should know. And I can't like remember like the where and the when. But what about you guys?
Well, I definitely remember where I heard about him. It was like, I guess it's getting on for 15 years ago now when the second Mr. Bean movie came out, Mr. Bean's Holiday. And in the kind of press around it, they basically said that this was like loosely inspired by Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, and that when Rowan Atkinson originally came up with the character of Mr. Bean, it was somewhat inspired by Jacques Tati. So that's where I'd heard of him, but it's only now, like years and years and years and years and years later, that I'm finally getting around to seeing one of those films. So,
J-Dog, you?
Well, I've been a huge Jacques Tati fan for many years. I have a Jacques tattoo.
Shut up.
No, I can't. I think, like you, once I became aware of Criterion is when I became aware of him. Because, you know, the covers for, like, Playtime, and even this one with the simple line drawing of the character, is a really cool thing. But I never sat down and watched the movie because, you know, it's like a 2-hour visual poem, and at least Playtime comes off that way. But for this one, I ended up watching his first feature length, which is Jour de Fête, and then Hulot's Holiday. So
you said you did see Playtime?
No, I started it one time, and he, like, I could tell it was, like, visually really cool, but I was watching it on, like, a tiny TV. I was like, I gotta wait to see this on a bigger thing, and then I just never went back to it.
Oh. Yeah, Playtime is his masterpiece, but that also... I love it, but at the same time, it's like, I'd rather talk about one of the fun ones. Not that it isn't fun, but it's like it's him at his artistic peak. And it really is. It's like a marvelous film in every way. Just, but it's my show. I guess your show too. But I want to talk about one of the more joyous ones. Mm-hmm. And it's like this pure fun. And
that's why we're talking about Jour de Fête. No.
I liked one a lot, but I think he got better as he went along. All right, you guys talk. I gotta take care of the animals again.
All right. So this was your first time with Hulot's Holiday. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I watched it a couple of times. Mm. So, yeah. It's kind of... I didn't really know what to expect at all, but it's kind of plotless, isn't it? Almost.
Right. I mean, it is literally just like it's a documentary about this man's holiday and how, you know, he spends some time at the beach and yeah. I'm so unfamiliar with the way European ideas of like getting away for a few days. It's like, is this ringing the bell so everybody has to eat at the same time? It was making me think of Titanic, where it's like, well, this is the scheduled meal time. Everybody comes to the meal room during this meal time.
Yeah, that seemed like very much harkening back to, you know, an era a long time before anything that I remember. Mm-hmm. Yeah, then again, like, whenever we went on holiday... you know, my family growing up, we tended to go to, like, little individual, like, caravans and stuff and, like, holiday cottages. So it was just us, you know, in a house somewhere. So, you know, I don't really have that experience of staying in a hotel
right.
like that. So, but I'd be very surprised if it was quite as, like, you know, this is when the meal times are. It was probably much more of a, like, this is when the meal window is, and it would be like 2.5-3 hours when, you know, certain things are served and you just kind of rock up when you're ready. It's kind of like much more, you know, individualized than this comes across as. Mm-hmm. I have to say, like, I don't know whether you guys are familiar with John Cleese's series Fawlty Towers, but
I'm very familiar. It's one of my favorites. Okay.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. Not much of this reminded me of Fawlty Towers, but I have to say, like, the interior restaurant scenes did remind me of that. Mm. I think some of that was just like the fact that you've got this kind of goofy waiter who doesn't really know what he's doing.
That kind of reminded me of that. Yeah,
and then just like the constant like swinging of doors and just like slight aura of chaos, but
yeah,
it's much more mild mannered than anything involving John Cleese, which always has like this kind of like just sort of slightly manic edge to it, which this really does not have.
Yeah, that's the cocaine. They didn't have cocaine back in Hulot's Holiday. They're all using opium.
Yeah, which is much more chilled out.
But Terry Jones from Monty Python is a huge Tati fan, and he said when he saw Holiday, I think he said he was like in his teens when he saw it. Those guys are like around that age when like they would have been teens in the 50s, I think.
Oh yeah,
sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was the first time he was like, he said, like, comedy can be funny and beautiful at the same time. And he just, like, talked about it in terms of like setting up gags and just, like, how everything is filmed. And Tati has, like, you see, like, Tati's, like, mime background in this movie. And all the movies, too, but there are a couple scenes in this that, like, it's really just, like, him, like, doing, like, a mime routine. But Terry Jones, like, just talked about this being a huge influence on him, and made me realize, like, Like, I knew Tati was a big figure with, like, comedy and film, but it wasn't until, like, the trailer for a few months ago, or whatever it was, for a new Wes Anderson movie, and I was like, oh, Wes Anderson likes Jacques Tati, and I don't know why it took me that long to realize that.
I mean...
I can definitely see that he would be into Tati.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, and he, like, and it could be something even far back or farther back than that, you know, something like a... I mean, obviously, Tati's inspired by, you know, Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin and even things like the Three Stooges. That's what I kept thinking of, the Three Stooges, because of the way everyone else was reacting to the silly things that was happening. In Three Stooges, everyone is playing the straight man except for the Stooges. And, you know, people are having accidents happen to them, but no one's reacting. Like, the guy getting smashed into the trunk of the car by the horse kicking. I'm like, that is a Stooges thing, except for, you know, Moe's head would be poking through a hole in the metal. Be like, when I get out of here, I'm going to, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, it was funny how most of the time, like... the other characters were quite oblivious to what was going on. Like the card game, for instance, where that guy gets switched from table to table and he just doesn't realize it's happening.
Everyone is so angry at him. I love it. Yeah. That you were talking about the waiter who kind of that waiter was the smartest guy in the movie because he immediately was, he's mumbling to himself like mother, you know, blah, blah, blah or whatever, because he saw Hulot and he was like, this guy is going to ruin my life. I just need to keep an eye on him the whole time.
Well, they really don't get off on the right foot with each other, do they? With his leaving the door open and it just blowing everything away. I think my favorite sight gag, you know, in a movie that is basically all sight gag, is the bit where the waiter dunks his whole arm and wristwatch. into the fish tank, because just the fact he's rolled up the other sleeve, like ready to go retrieve this pipe, then he momentarily gets distracted by something that Ulo is doing, and then he goes back to the task in hand and just dunks his whole arm in there. It's just like, oh, you silly man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a such great setup of like he's gonna do it, and then he gets distracted by the fact that his like arch enemy is there. And then that just Hulo just ruins everything for him in every chance he can.
Yeah,
there was that guy. I think that guy's the proprietor. Like that, somebody specifically signals out, like, "Oh, that's the proprietor." Which is funny because him and the waiter dressed exactly the same, have the same haircut. It's kind of funny, but. You know, that guy's worried this hotel is going to be ruined. And when the fireworks start going off, I was like, if that hotel burns down, 5 out of 5 stars. they decided not to do that this time, though.
I did wonder how they did that. And, you know, Tati didn't end up setting himself on fire. Because it looks really impressive, but it also looks... hella dangerous.
Yeah, super dangerous.
Yeah, it had like the vibe of like a old like Hong Kong action movie of like, oh, he could have died watching that.
Indeed Buster Keaton, where it's just like, exactly, you better get this right, man.
Yeah, if you fall off that train, you're dead. Or if you're standing in the wrong spot, that house will fall on you.
Yeah. Yeah, nightmare for the insurance company.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but I'm not sure if you guys did looked up any background on Tati, but I'm not sure if you could tell, but it's pretty clear. Like, you know, like he was an athlete, and like it really shows that this with how much control he has over his body, because like he's basically silent. He says, I think, 2 words that you can make out. Whole time, and then the rest is just his
hardly anything.
And the rest of this is pure physicality and knowing like how to maneuver his body. And I think it was rugby or tennis or one of those sports that's big in Europe.
He did seem proficient at tennis.
He certainly did, yeah. I did think I briefly scanned the Wikipedia article, and I think I saw that he was a semi-pro rugby player at one point.
Jeez.
I mean, you can see why. He's a big guy. I mean, he's not like particularly muscly, but he's very tall and imposing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's 6'3", and I saw a comparison. I think it was Ebert or someone comparing Hulot to the Tramp, and saying like the Tramp can hide behind things, and the Tramp is like you know, gets in trouble and kind of gets in people's way, but he's small and can blend in, where Hulot is just too tall and he sticks out like a sore thumb everywhere he is.
He really does, and he has a very distinctive gait. Like when he walks, he's kind of like leaning forward, almost to the point that he's going to tip over.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I mean, yeah, obviously there's quite a few times where he does like lose his balance for various different reasons and ends up like falling through things. But yeah, it does have a very different energy to like Chaplin and particularly Keaton. It's not quite as like frantic and fast.
Yeah,
it's much more like laid back, apart from maybe the fireworks scene, which is not that at all.
Right.
Yeah, like it's very leisurely paced.
Mm.
Like I want to call it like Ozu pacing, where it's like the pace of real life, but it's like Ozu stuff is like very like trying to replicate like this what feels like to sit and talk with someone, where this is kind of in that vein a little bit, but it's more artificial, and it's more like this a long setup to a gag that is going to pay off at some point. And you're not quite sure when it's going to pay off. You just know it will pay off at some point.
Like the taffy pulling. I assume that was taffy and not some sort of weird ice cream.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what that was. It did not look very appealing, not least to the number of people who've just had like their hands on it.
Yeah, and the man himself who's not wearing gloves at the beach,
no.
Just pulling it, pushing it back in again, like, this taffy's a little crunchy, whatever.
Yeah, a little grimy.
And there's that one moment when Tati's going back to the hotel, and he sees it's slumping over again, and then the guy catches it. Once he notices Hulot's looking at it.
Yeah.
I say this is the already the second occurrence of La Glace from the French movies we've watched, Spencer, because in La Pointe Court they also had a little ice cream stand.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, when the littlest, that really tiny kid has the two ice creams in each hand. I was sure something was going to happen with those, but it was almost like he was like, I'm not going to do something mean to this little kid. I'm just going to make you think that I might.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so adorable.
He's used to children. Yeah. Sorry.
No, you can go first.
I was just going to say his use of children. Like he's, you know me, Spencer, I get irritated by children, especially children actors. But since I think because they're all silent, they're just like adorable. So compliments to him.
And like that, like with the little kid with the ice cream, like you see his little hand with money, and like it's so heartwarming, and you feel like I forgot about that part, but I didn't think it'd be that mean spirited because it never feels that mean. It just feels like I don't know how to explain like the Tati sensibility, but it's very specific.
I mean, he sets you up so that you're going to be on the, not on the edge of your seat, but on a slight like, this is what I expect to happen. So when the kid is turning the doorknob and his ice cream cone literally goes upside down and does not fall out, you're like, oh, okay, good.
Yeah, the only like one mean, like slightly mean thing, but then I wasn't quite sure how to interpret it, is when Ulo sees that guy like leaning over on the beach and he like properly punts him in the backside. And I wasn't sure, like the second time round I was kind of like, does he think that that guy is like peering into the like the changing booth?
That is,
and he's
yeah, exactly.
That's how you read it, okay? Because the first time I wasn't quite sure.
You thought he was just getting a good kick in.
I just thought like, yeah, he was like suddenly like overtaken by this like I see this butt bending over. I feel the need to kick it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I get that urge occasionally.
No, he didn't want that guy to be a pervert, but he was wrong about it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah, that guy's just an asshole. He's not a pervert.
Yeah, who are your guys' favorite like side characters that kept showing up? I really like the young socialist who won't shut up about like which I'm not saying that his politics were bad, just saying like change your approach, buddy. Like it's just not working.
Yeah.
He didn't seem to be picking up the social cues that people aren't necessarily wanting to discuss this right now. And he just kind of carried on oblivious. He definitely had a certain, like, in terms of the way he was styled. I mean, he obviously didn't have the goatee, but there was something kind of like Leon Trotsky about him.
Oh, for sure. With his glasses and his hair is kind of like pushed up in a way that, like, yeah, is very reminiscent of a like a stereotypical depiction of the, you know, people that would be talking that way. So
yeah,
it's like a type.
Yeah. Yes.
Look kind of like Barton Fink a little bit too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Wrestling movies.
Yeah.
I think one of my favorite side characters was the World War I vet, who was just very, I mean, it's never obviously spelt out that he's a World War I vet, but I guess just from like when it's set and his age that he would probably, that's where his like military training is. And just, I don't know, just his very, like, just how seriously this guy takes himself and the fact that he thinks that everyone wants to hear his war stories. And that one bit where there's, again, from context, he must be talking to a British or American tourist, but he doesn't really speak English at all. So he just like speaks at him really fast in French. And occasionally like every like 12th word drops in an English word. Like, and he thinks that will do. He's just a silly, silly character, but
I can confirm that would actually work. Yeah. I'd be like, Yeah, I think my favorite was the couple that are constantly just like walking around. It's the wife and the husband, and there's that one scene where they both leave the hotel, but for some reason the wife is like distracted and she like turns around. The husband's like looking at her, and she opens the door again, and she turns and looks at her husband and goes, "Oh, there you are." Like, he was right next to her the whole time. She just didn't turn the right direction. And because it's like, I kept expecting something really weird to happen with them because they seemed like they were kind of snooping, but they were just constantly meandering around together and, you know, interacting kind of with the situation. But I don't remember anything specifically bad happening. I was just amused every time I saw them like poking their head or commenting on something very quickly.
Yeah. And, where was it? The World War One veteran guy. That feels like a callback to the first film, Jour de Fille, where like the postman keeps trying to tell people about his day, and no one cares.
Yep. Maurice, he's drunk. I made a mistake, I have to say. I liked Jour de Fille better than Willow's Holiday.
That's fine.
It wasn't, I think it was because of the pace. Like, Jour de Fille is way more like joke after joke after joke. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing wrong with Holiday.
It's very languidly paced, isn't it? Yeah, I was, it felt to me like slightly long for a movie that's less than 90 minutes.
Yeah.
But I do really respect how it takes its time. And, like, it's not even, like, necessarily wall-to-wall gags or even setups. Like, you get quite a lot of incidental, just, like, little, like, bits of life that are happening in between the comic scenes,
mm-hmm.
Which just... I can't remember seeing too many comedy films that have as much atmosphere as this. Or to be honest, that are as pretty to look at. Like, the cinematographer really, really, like, was taking pride in his work, I feel like, with this.
Yeah,
like, so many scenes are just the framing is so nice, and the, like... You know, quite often they do things like an angle, like looking up and looking down, and there's like just kind of like different levels and stuff. Like, it's not just a kind of like flat, you know, two people who are, you know, at the same position in a frame. So I guess that's possibly where the Wes Anderson admiration, like, part of it comes in, like, because he seems to really enjoy, you know, like having stuff happening like way over in the background.
Yeah, like, no frame is boring. There's always something of interest. Where is it? Okay, so, Jolly, actually, Alistair, maybe you too, but you probably are familiar with the Tramp character, the Chaplin character, and
I've seen a couple.
Okay. But, like, a Hulo is, like, a variation on the Tramp in certain ways. Because, like, it's a tribute to Chaplin more so than Keaton and Harold Lloyd. But, like, down to where the Tramp leans backwards, this is, like, the inverse where a Hulo leans forward.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, a lot of small things and... what was it? I was looking up, like, where Hulo came from, the name. And the only thing that came up was the French name for the tramp is Charlot. Or Chalot? I haven't heard it that loud. But basically, it's
Chalet?
Yeah. But basically, like, it's just a, you know, it's like, a similar sounding name to the French name for the tramp, so it's like a tribute slash like a clear like a reference point for what Tati was doing with the character.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it feels to me like these all the people who like stand out as characters in the at least the two movies I've seen could be archetypes of like people he's actually known or experienced or whatever. So, you know, maybe this is somebody who knows it's a slight variation on the name. That would be funny. But, yeah, I have no idea.
Yeah, there's not much biographical information on Tati that's not from him. And there's some stories. There's one about his father. Okay, so to bring in the Russian part, his grandfather was the Russian military attaché in Paris. Dmitry, what's the last name again, Alistair?
Tatashev.
And Todd and Jacques' dad was kidnapped by his Russian family that lived in Russia, basically. And so Jacques' grandma had to go to Russia to rescue his dad to take him back to Paris. But there's some speculation that Tati was kind of, was just telling a good story, and that never really happened. So, I got the feeling he didn't do that many interviews or that much, because there just wasn't that much about, like, his life or anything. So, it's kind of like a, you know, like one of those, like, big, like, Fellini, like, anything you see about Fellini, about his life. If it's from him, there's a good chance it might be just complete bullshit.
I'll have to
not letting the truth get in the way of a good story.
Yeah.
It's not about the creator, it's about the creation.
Yeah.
Apparently he tinkered with, I don't know whether with all of his films, but with this film a lot. Like, he was constantly like coming back to it and chopping little bits out and like playing with the sound and stuff. And apparently, like, he was doing it like right to the end, almost to the end of his life, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, the 90-minute cut is from the 70s, and that was and there's a Jaws joke in it because he wanted to re-release it with the Jaws joke because Jaws was a big hit.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah,
I really like the boat bit.
Yeah, it's so silly, but I really enjoy it. So that wasn't actually in the original release. It was just stuff that had ended up on the cutting room floor.
I watched the theatrical cut from the 50s, and the boat scene was in that, but it's it just breaks in half, and he cuts back to him on land, and he's completely dry.
Right.
Okay.
I thought the shark part didn't make sense in context of the time period. Like, would they actually be afraid of sharks in France? Like, then, like, so that explains that, but not. I mean, it's not a big deal or anything like that. I just thought it was like, huh.
It's close enough in that you can see it's not actually a shark. It just looks a bit like one. It does kind of like, you know, stretches the suspension of disbelief a little bit, but it doesn't matter because it just looks cool and funny.
I thought it was a real shark, but I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not a sharkologist or anything like that. Is this the movie where he is sitting in the chair in the boat and his like paint can goes in by pulled out by the by the tide? I was blown away by that because how can you even time that?
Oh, me too. I was like, they must have done this with some kind of wire or something, but you can't see you can't see it at all. Like, yeah. So I don't know how they did it. It's very simple to look at, like a simple gag, but like just practically, it looks like it must have been so hard to make it work.
It's the ocean. You can't tell it what to do.
No. Famously, we had over in this country, we had a English/Danish king who supposedly tried that, or indeed didn't actually try that. He was making a point about how he had only limited amount of power, even though he was, you know, super big deal king.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I didn't imagine I would be bringing King Canute into this podcast episode, but there he is.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Yeah. So, were you guys surprised that Hulot is not the main character? That's literally just like, it's just like a week at this vacation place in the 50s.
Yeah, I guess a bit. I mean, the first time I watched it, it seemed like, oh, this is taking quite a long time for the main guy to arrive. Like, you've almost got like, 10 minutes of just kind of like traveling there. I mean, yes, it's him in his car, but you don't see him, the man, until about like 10 or 11 minutes in.
Yeah.
I think because I'd watched his first film before this, and that's another one where, like, you don't expect the mailman to be the main character, but once he shows up, you're sticking around with the mailman the whole time. And he doesn't show up until like 15 to 20 minutes into that movie, which is a short movie. But I guess that set me. I was like, well, he's going to show up eventually. I mean, his name's on the movie. He has to be here.
Yeah.
Sorry, this is a bit of a tangent, but how did you guys like the music?
Very calming.
I liked it a lot.
It's very chill. The second time, actually, I noticed that most of the time it's meant to be diegetic. I didn't pick up on that the first time, but yeah, second time it's like, oh, most of the time it's somebody putting on a record.
Yeah, I made a joke to Sarah that everybody really loves that one song that they keep playing, because I'll turn on the record player or whatever, and it's always that song. Except for Hulo, who is listening to the loudest, you know, big band record he can find by himself in the room.
Well, again, this I didn't necessarily notice as much the first time, but when that little kid, he's not that little, but like preteen kid, puts the same like big loud record on later in the movie. I think that's the second time we see that kid do something where he's kind of copying Hulo, which I quite enjoyed. I like the fact that the switch just turns off all the electricity in the room. It turns off the light and the record player. Kind of like, huh, interesting wiring situation there. That wouldn't be up to code these days.
Yeah, I had a switch like that at a place I used to work, where it was just like, It had a note on it that said, don't touch this switch. It's like, why not? He's like, yeah, that switch for some reason controls all the power. I'm like, wow.
I lived in Russia for 5 years, so I am not unfamiliar with the slightly like, this doesn't look altogether safe.
They're all plugged. Everything was plugged into the same cord. That's why in Russia, like literally, it's just one cord.
Central planning.
Right. What do you guys think of the young lady character, Martina?
I'm glad she wasn't like overly sexualized. She was just kind of like, everyone was like, ooh, what a pretty lady or something like that. But I feel like if it was a different movie, we'd have way more male gazy things going on there. But that didn't seem to be a problem in general, you know.
Yeah, it was like more like how some of the characters were reacting to her rather than what the camera was doing, I felt like. Like, it wasn't kind of like Michael Bay, pervy, oh, well, we're going to zoom in on certain body parts. It wasn't that at all.
Yeah, it wasn't the Transformers bending over to fix a car shot. It was just like, you see, like, you know, occasionally, like, young men being like, oh, she's wearing short shorts. And it's like, yeah.
Oh, and very early on in the movie, the two teenage boys who are both, like, walking in opposite directions, but they're both, like, staring at her, so they kind of, like, walk into each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same kids, I think, that will, like, be right behind her walking, and when she turns around, they turn the other way and start walking or It's good for jokes and, like that.
Yeah, and then the older couple where they're on the beach and the old man is just like staring and his wife is like oi, pay attention. And it's just like, that was quite awkward.
There's a really weird line with some of the young people, because I think she might be like college age or maybe early 20, like maybe post-college. Because at some point she's with some young people her own age, and one of the guys says, "I got some new Super American records. Do you want to listen to them?" And I was like, "What does Super American record mean? Jazz?"
I don't know.
I guess this is 1953, right?
Yeah.
So is rock and roll? Has rock and roll started at this point, or is it just about to start?
It probably would have been started, it was still a black music. It wasn't colonized yet.
Right.
I'm wondering when, like, Buddy Holly and Jerry Lee Lewis and things like that, like Elvis.
I feel like they'd be a couple years, because Elvis is more to late 50s.
Let me see what Jerry Lee Lewis started. Not that it has to be anything specific.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe. Because this is before the plane crash.
Oh yeah, not until 56. So, I mean, it was. I'm sure there were a bunch of things leading up to the, you know, the famous white people who got famous also off of sounding not white.
Who made all the money? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Little Richard was successful, but he's kind of like the one black one of that of that group.
You know, it's the Beatles were listening to a lot of black music, and that inspired them to, you know, I mean, before so they were the Beatles, right?
Yeah, I mean, so was Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and all those other bands. Mm-hmm. Britain got it, but America was like, nah, we don't want that for some reason.
Well, we did. We just didn't want, you know.
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
You know. Mm-hmm. Racism. Yeah.
then again, Eric Clapton was very much inspired by the blues, but then he got like massively addicted to drugs and alcohol, and then would just like spout this horrible racism. And it's kind of like, that's awful, but it's like even more awful somehow, that it's kind of like you've made your like fortune playing black music, and now you're being a massive racist. This is just, oh my goodness.
Yeah. He covered "I Shot the Sheriff," the Bob Marley song, and then after that is a famous clip of him talking about send all Jamaicans out of Britain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look it up if you don't know what I'm talking about.
This is news to me. Thank you for letting me know, for God's sake.
Yeah, oh yeah, he's a real piece of shit.
Yeah, I mean, I think later on he was like ashamed of his behavior, and I think he did apologize, but yeah, it's just like, ugh.
Yeah, there's
damage done.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to make it clear that like racism isn't, you know, limited to America. We have plenty of it over in this country.
That's not what I heard. Brexit.
right. That was nothing to do with racism at all. No. It was all about sovereignty.
Obviously.
Ugh, obviously. Yeah. Actually, this as a former European citizen, this film just made me like latently like just nostalgic and sad and kind of angry, because it's just like, if I wanted to, I could have like retired to France and that would have been fine, whereas now if I wanted to do that, I'd have to jump through all these hoops, which I know is probably like, to you guys, sounds just a bit rich, but it's just like, ugh, I don't know, stupid UK politics.
Yep.
Yeah,
like, maybe. We had a good thing going.
Yeah, well, hopefully in the future things will change.
Yeah, I'm hoping by the time I retire, we'll have rejoined, but it's just like...
Retirement? That's crazy. That doesn't exist in America anymore.
Yeah.
You're lucky.
Yeah, well, it's to be honest, it's starting to move like further and further away. Like, they keep moving the age up, so it's kind of like... Yeah, not sure I'm gonna make it.
Oh, yeah, I think you'll be better off than me and Joel.
Well,
marginally.
But now that you have a rampant socialist president, as...
yeah. I think at this point, people complaining about politics while listening to this episode have reached the point.
Yeah, let's move on. Okay, so
I'm sorry, you know, I'm just being facetious.
No, we're all doing it.
Yeah.
I got a lot to say.
if you don't like our politics, then why did you listen to Spike Lee season?
they didn't. They came to listen to this French one because they're very cultured.
Yeah, and France is a famously apolitical country.
That is correct.
They're just like, oh, les politiques.
Yeah.
I do not care.
I just heard them talking about how their government is afraid of the people, as opposed to America, where we're afraid of the government. You know, it's no politics.
Yeah.
And to be honest, based on French history, you've got plenty of reason to be scared of the government.
But on the topic of France, Hulot's Holiday won the... One can the year it was there in 53 or 54, which I think is the only comedy to ever win it, or maybe one of the very, very few comedies to ever win.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know a ton about the Cannes Film Festival, but certainly, like, the stereotype of it that I have in my mind is that it's very serious and highbrow, so comedy is automatically, like, out.
Yeah, I guess, like,
What is the name of their number one award?
Palme d'Or.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think it was the Palme d'Or, because Grand Prix, I think, didn't do that for a stretch. Mm-hmm. I could look it up, but I'm going off of memory. Let's just stick with that.
It is Palme d'Or. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but like Parasite kind of was a comedy, but that's like the closest I think they'd come to a comedy gain that level of attention now.
Right.
And I haven't seen it, but I get from what I've heard about it, it's like quite a dark, like satirical comedy, which tends to be regarded very differently from something that's essentially like visual slapstick humor, which a lot of people are snobby about. I mean, including me when I was in my like late teens, early 20s, I was kind of like, oh, physical humor, that is not funny. That is something I liked when I was a child. But now I am far too grown up for that kind of nonsense.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then people said, you should really see some Buster Keaton. And I was like, okay. Yeah, and I kind of got over myself, at least a little bit.
Yeah. So.
But on that note, I feel like Jim Carrey must be a fan of Tati, because some of the it's like the way, like some like the mime routines he would do, like with the horse, trying to tame the horse, like that feels like a very Jim Carrey type of thing.
Jim Carrey is a perfect example, because I understand exactly what you're saying, Alistair, because a lot of the things that are physical comedy today, and you know, within my lifetime, had the unfortunate need for your character actor to be constantly expressing it. Oh no, what? Oh no, you know, oh, this is crazy, blah blah blah, Jim Carrey with his snappy lines. And I think that totally takes away from the physicality of like the production. You know, Hulot being mostly silent, you can't help but focus on what's going on with his actions. And the same thing with, you know, the Tramp and Buster Keaton and, even Jackie Chan. Like, because Jackie Chan is not doing constant one-liners in, you know, his classic Hong Kong stuff, you can really focus on his stunt work and, like, the environment around there. And people like Jim Carrey just cannot shut up. They have to try to punctuate a situation by saying something ridiculous to get that laugh line, which they already had by, you know, doing the physical comedy thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and going back to Mr. Bean, my brother and I, for some reason, like, our favorite, like, shared film is the, like, the 1997 Bean movie. But out of the two Mr. Bean films, like, probably the second one, Mr. Bean's Holiday, is probably, like, truer to that whole kind of, like, silent comedy, just, like, visually orientated thing. And I think it's probably, like, objectively the better film. I think the two of us just have, like, a nostalgia for watching that when we were teenagers. I actually rewatched it on Friday before this recording. It's very different. Like, the idea that it's just ripping off Monsieur Hulot's Holiday that's not at all the case, because it's a very different film. But yeah, I don't know why I'm bringing Mr. Bean back into it, but
it makes sense. Like, Mr. Bean is kind of like the closest modern, like, silent comedy thing that's like kind of mainstream. Yeah, because everything
but
else
it's definitely more grotesque, though. Like, Monsieur Hulot is certainly, like, exaggerated from real life, but he's still, like, kind of, like, semi-believable, whereas Mr. Bean is just a cartoon character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't see Hulot being listed as a Palme d'Or winner. He must have won something else at Cannes.
Maybe Terry Jones mentioned it in the thing.
Oh yeah, he's an idiot. So no, I'm just kidding.
Terry Jones. Okay, you can tell him that.
I will. Next time we talk to him. Isn't he dead? No.
I think he died. He died either earlier this year or late last year.
Yeah, I had to double check. I was like, wait, is it Eric Idle or Michael Palin? I know. I was thinking like one of them just died. I just can't remember which one. But it Terry Jones is the one. So I think only three of the five are still with us.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're all still with us apart from Graham Chapman and Terry Jones.
Yeah.
Because Palin, Idle, and Gilliam.
Gilliam. Cleese. Yeah.
And those two are kind of, I don't like what they turned into, but
yeah, Cleese or Gilliam, yeah, they can go hang out wherever they're going to hang out.
Yeah.
Thank you for the funny memories.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, would you guys recommend Monsieur Hulot's Holiday?
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend it, but I would say, like, possibly you have to be in the right mood. But yeah, it's good.
I mean,
all right.
I do think that, I wonder how children would react to seeing this movie.
Hmm.
Because, well, I don't even know what kids are watching nowadays, but, like, it's also making me think of, like, you know, because I was talking about Three Stooges, making me think of Tom and Jerry, and like the chaos and funniness of that. Now that's super fast paced, like Looney Tunes, same thing. But
yeah, I feel like with this, you have to have a half decent attention span, just because. I mean, there are a lot of jokes, but yeah, like we were saying earlier, there's sometimes like a little bit of a wait while they set up the punchline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it is definitely worth watching, and it is. There are some like downtime periods, but like there's so many like individual funny bits. Like we got Alistair's favorite part. My favorite joke in the entire movie was when Hulot accidentally drives into that cemetery.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And he's trying to change his tire, and he drops it into the leaves, and he picks it up, and the guy who's bringing in the wreath just looks at him as like, okay, obviously that's another wreath. And just Hulot hands it over, because it's like, okay.
Yeah.
It just made me laugh really hard.
My favorite gag for me would be when you see when he opens the door and it's Wendy, and
out of there,
the cats climb into bags.
They do.
It's all, I know, but it's too noisy for that right now.
Mm-hmm.
Opens the door and it's super windy. You see this guy's mustache flapping in the wind.
Yeah. It's not quite a Dali moustache, but it's a very luxuriant moustache, and it is getting really pulled around by the wind there.
Yeah, but my favorite moment of the whole movie is in the beginning when on the radio, the radio host says like says goodbye, and Tati doffs his hat at the radio.
Yeah,
because like he's so like Hulot's such a polite, nice character that like he has to like, you know, greet everyone, and like even has to like, you know, be respectful towards like the radio host, even though it's absurd and silly.
he drives people, and they assume he's like a taxi for some reason, and he's just drive them wherever they need to go. Another polite thing in the same cemetery scene is when he helps those guys help him, and he like shakes their hands, but everyone from the funeral procession assumes they're like, oh, we're supposed to go shake this guy's hand, hold on. And he like breaks character and starts laughing because
he gets his nose tickled.
Oh yeah, by the woman's feather.
Yeah, well, and also I think this is like a French cultural thing. I think the Russians do this as well. Is just there's a bit of a like all men are meant to shake all other men's hands. Like if you're like coming into a space, you kind of have to acknowledge each other with a handshake. Mm. I don't know whether that's still true in France, but I definitely heard that was true in the past, and that did seem to be very much a thing in Russia. If like a group of acquaintances like meet and you're like you join them, you kind of have to shake everyone's hand to say hello.
After this year, let's hope that this is just a historical document and handshaking will be a thing of the past.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it also harkens back to, like, you know, Hulot's just like an old-fashioned guy in every way, to his car, the way he dresses, you know, like... But then again, it's moved from the 50s, so I don't know, like, what was still, like, widely practiced in France at the time.
Mm.
All right, so we don't have much time left, but I'd recommend this. Obviously, my uncle, his next movie, I think is better, and you get more dogs and more stuff with kids, and it's like, although it's more of him being like kind of figuring out like what he wants to do with film and like the Hulu character. And Holiday is this, you know, like it's a great place to start if you haven't seen any Tati. It's a good way to know like if you're going to like it or like his style or not. But yeah. Mm-hmm. But so this is 1953. There's yes.
Wow.
Where is it?
Oh, I thought you meant this year. Okay, sorry.
No, it's 53.
As opposed to the dreaded 2020, which, thank goodness, is nearly over.
Yeah. So, it's a pretty decent year for movies. I haven't seen that many. Mm. I just have... Well, Joel, you can mention the ones we did for Kurosawa season.
Okay.
I think we just did, like... No, we did the one for Kurosawa season.
I assume you're talking about The Little Fugitive, directed by Ray Ashley and Morris Engel, and there's another director. What is the name of that person? Ruth Orkin, which is about a little boy who really wants to go to the fair, but no one's around to take him, or he doesn't have money, I can't remember, but he ends up getting money somehow, and then we watch this kid, like, do all the stuff at the fair. But he's also worried he's going to get arrested because he thinks his brother played a joke on him, and the kid actually thinks he shot and killed him, so he's hiding from the cops at the fair. And it's a really funny movie, and it's very much like a French New Wave movie, but it's an American production. That's not what you were talking about. I'm sorry. You were talking about Gate of Hell, which actually did win the Palme d'Or.
Maybe my uncle Terry Jones was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Gate of Hell, I liked it. I remember you liked it less than I did, but it is...
Yeah.
It's kind of a... Not too weird of a story. Like, by the time we saw Gate of Hell... In the Kurosawa section of the podcast, we'd already seen so many stories like it. Like, the colors are cool and stuff like that. But I didn't remember it being anything other than a very solid, you know, 90-minute long history tale. So it's I would recommend it, but it's not, you know, it's not an actual Kurosawa movie. So I feel like it kind of is missing that style.
It's a good solid movie, but it's not. You know, if you're into like Japanese movies of the time period, watch it by all means. But the director who did a movie in the 20s called Page of Madness that is apparently very good and experimental, and it's one of the few like Japanese movie silent movies that's still like that we still have, because a lot of them are gone forever.
Lost to the sands of time.
And, yeah, World War II. That kind of destroyed a lot of it. But, 1953, Roman Holiday, Audrey Hepburn. You know the movie.
Oh, of course. Yes.
What else? Ugetsu. But, more importantly, Roman Holiday. That's the better of the movie of the two, in my opinion. But Ugetsu is also a classic and should be watched if you like spooky ghost stories and period dramas.
Mm-hmm. I've not seen it yet.
It's Mizoguchi, so it's gonna be depressing and sad.
Yeah, I haven't seen any Mizoguchi, but I have heard that he is super depressing, and also that Tarkovsky really liked him, and Tarkovsky isn't exactly a barrel of laughs.
That makes sense. That Tarkovsky would have been a Mizoguchi fan.
Yeah, apart from that one random scene in Stalker when they're in that kind of like rundown building in the zone and suddenly the phone rings and a guy picks up and goes, "Hello, no, he's not here," and then slams the phone back down. It's like the one like comedy moment in Tarkovsky, and because it's Tarkovsky, you're not even sure whether it's actually meant to be a joke or not.
Yeah. Although, let's take too much time, but I recently saw a picture where he was playing with like his a German Shepherd, like going on a hike, and it's like, oh, I've never seen him like happy in a picture before.
Yeah, he definitely did seem to project like tortured artist. I have a couple of 1953 films, if you're interested.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one is Malta Story. Which is mostly for personal reasons. I briefly lived in Malta for reasons that are too complicated to get into. But while I was there, I worked in the Lascaris War Rooms, which is kind of there.
Were you in Popeye?
I was not, and I sadly never actually visited the sets. But yeah, I had heard that the live action Popeye was filmed there. I think I only found that out after the fact, actually. But yeah, I do know that it's, you know, used as a movie location a fair bit. But yeah, Malta Story is set during World War II, and it has Alec Guinness as like a whimsical observation pilot. He's not a fighter pilot. He's like a spy mission pilot. And he falls in love with a Maltese girl who works in like the intelligence room as like a plotter, so kind of like plotting the positions of like RAF and then enemy planes. It's a cool story, and it's got, you know, really really like gorgeous visuals of the island and some, you know, some nicely incorporated like it's like newsreel footage. And of course, it's Alec Guinness, which he's always good to watch. Mm-hmm. So I would recommend that one as a an interesting movie. And then there's a couple of Ida Lupino films from that year as well. Have either of you guys seen The Bigamist or The Hitchhiker?
I don't think I've seen any Ida Lupino.
I've seen her acting, not her directing.
Hmm. Yeah, I think those are the only two of hers that I've seen. Although I know she did like quite a few. Both are really really good. Like The Hitchhiker is a very like tense like noir-y film about these two friends who are like just hanging out and like going for a drive, like I think it's somewhere in California, and they basically get like their car hijacked by this like psychotic guy who basically who's just been like going around like murdering people like in the desert. It's very, very tense. I mean, the ending is kind of a bit silly, but it's it's super atmospheric and The Hitchhiker.
Oh man, I'm writing this down.
Yeah, it's good. And then the other one is The Bigamist, which obviously a very sensationalist title, but yeah, it is about this like kind of failed-ish businessman who ends, as the title suggests, ends up marrying a woman when he's already married. It's very well done though. Like you feel like he's a terrible guy, but you kind of understand how he kind of fell into that situation. And Ida Lupino herself is plays the second woman that he marries. It's very good. I'm not doing it justice, but
I believe you. I just found a movie I forgot. Wagers of Fear. It's great, super tense. Kinda remade a Sorcerer, the Friedkin movie.
I mean, it's totally remade as.
Friedkin will tell you a different story.
No.
Yeah, he disputes that. He said it's not a remake, but
I don't care what he fucking says. If you watch one after the other, it's a fucking remake.
I know, but he likes to. He talks way too much about shit. But he shouldn't. He says dumb shit sometimes. What I'm getting at. But yeah, Wager of Fear is great. And Sorcerer, according to Friedkin, is not a remake. But it
just happens to have the exact same. Anyway,
pure coincidence.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And if I may mention one more, 1953, to counter the idea that I don't like all musicals, Gentlemen Prefer Blonde. Prefer Blonde, singular.
Prefer Blondie?
Blondes. Howard Hawks musical is super entertaining and very, very much fun. I think Marilyn Monroe is great, but Jane Russell is insanely good in this movie. Like, and the songs are fun and catchy. The stories, sometimes those stories just kind of like wander off to nowhere, but like this one's like entertaining the whole way through. Yeah.
All right.
Oh, cool. I've only ever seen bits of that movie.
I hope Alexandria hears this to know you do like musicals sometimes. But yeah, the movie I'm sure is more than just that gif of Jane Russell looking at the muscle man.
Yeah,
that you see a lot.
That whole musical bit is great.
Yeah. All right, Alistair, you got to go do personal stuff or whatever. So
yeah, move to a place which actually has running water.
Yeah.
I thought the problem was you had too much running water.
Yes, and then the second thing. Yeah, as they decided, we should probably switch that off now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, fortunately it's not in our actual apartment, but still. Yes, that's the joy of living in an apartment block. But anyway, you can cut this all out. But...
Okay, I will. If I remember to.
No worries, no worries.
All right, so Rooster Files Unite season 4? 3?
Oh, yeah, no, we're on 5 now. 5? Yeah, so, coming up to 50th episode, as I'm not nearly as prolific as some people, but...
Congratulations.
Yeah, and I've got another podcast as well now. I somehow ended up, like, on one random episode of Roost Files, my friend Lynn and I joked about starting an REM podcast, and then we decided to follow through and actually do it. So we're now doing a track-by-track podcast about REM songs from like the very beginning of their career, and that is called Gentlemen Don't Get Caught. And yes, we end up going off on very bizarre tangents because we almost never do our homework. It turns out it's much harder to find things to say about songs than it is about movies. It's a lot of fun.
Lucky for you, REM is no longer around, so you will end at some point.
Yes, it's not one where, yeah, they're going to be constantly like releasing a new album and like pushing it back the end date of the podcast into infinity.
A friend of the show, and sort of friend of real life, Daniel Daughtry, formerly of the Lesser Bonaparte's podcast and the canon something? That's about the literary canon. He's a smarty pants like PhD guy. Anyway, Daniel is a big REM fan, and my friend Daniel met Michael Stipe at airport once.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And they went on a date.
No, Daniel was in high school at the time.
They went on a date.
All right.
Oh, this is so much better.
Okay, anyways, when's the Rene Russo podcast come along there?
It's a work in progress.
Okay. Well, let me know.
Will do. All right.
Thank you for coming
on. Oh, yeah, speaking of works in progress, when's the next The Dead Move Fast coming out?
As soon as you edit it. I don't know. It's coming out. I mean, you know, I'm a very slow worker.
No, I totally get it. Just wanted to let you know that it is hotly anticipated.
You're like, I read chapter 3 of Dracula 6 months ago, and I'm ready for chapter 4. What the hell?
Super.
All right. So thank you, Alistair, for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me on.
All right. And we might do another Tati episode down the road on maybe Playtime or Traffic or, I don't know, there might be some other Russian connection, very loose Russian connections I can figure out. Or you can just, you know, come on anytime you feel like. It doesn't have to be Russia connected.
Yeah, I do like other films. This should be stated. It was just that it seemed like an obvious niche with my, you know, many years of living in Moscow and my, you know, very rusty Russian skills.
Yeah. All right. So this will come out February, January, around that time, something like that. So the next pairing is Breathless. Godard. Yay! More Godard.
Oh, I have not seen that since I was 20 or 21.
Oh, and La Ventura, Antonioni, another movie I'm not too big on, but we're going to have to cover it, so. Yeah, the next two episodes, I don't know. I don't know how enthusiastic I will be.
Important to manage expectations.
Yeah, I feel like Joel will like those movies significantly more than I do.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah. All right, so see you guys
fair
next
enough,
time.
Fair enough. Thank you, and au revoir.
Same thing in French.
Sayonara.
That was your old podcast.
Ah.
The show can be found on Twitter at PianoPlayerPod. Our email is still highandlowpod@gmail.com. You can find a show on Spotify, Podbean, and various other places where you can find podcasts. Our intro music is by Vivian Fopp, and our cover art is by Sarah Roberts. You can find her art, sarahkathleenroberts.com, and thank you for listening.